Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today. This is Kelly Barner, editor of Buyer's Meeting Point. Today, I would like to welcome Professor Sameer Dhani as my guest. Professor Dhani is the author of Food Supply Chain Management and Logistics, From Farm to Fork. Food Supply Chain was published in June of 2015, and you can read my review on Buyer's Meeting Point. I will share a link to it on today's episode page. Professor Dhani is the head of logistics, operations, and hospitality management at the University of Huddersfield. He has experience working on projects related to food supply chain risks, food sustainability, and food value chains. Professor Dhani has published widely and has presented to both academic and practitioner audiences. Most recently, his book received the Prix des Associations Award at the Procurement Authors Award Ceremony in Paris for its comprehensive coverage of the design, governance, supporting mechanisms, and future challenges in the food supply chain. Professor Dhani, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Kelly. Thank you for inviting me for this call.
You're welcome. We're glad to have you. So before I ask you a few questions about the book, would you please share sort of a high-level synopsis of the book, especially the farm-to-fork concepts for people who have not read it?
Right. So this book deals with the movement of food from the farms to our plates. The book talks about the various operations. The book talks about the various challenges, the barriers that are faced within this food supply chain to get the food to our plates in the right consistency, in the right safety considerations, so that we can enjoy our food to the fullest. It's a book that encompasses a lot of varied topics that cannot be found in one particular book in the market. What I've tried to do is tell the story through various viewpoints, from political issues to operational issues to availability and sustainability issues. So it's a book that really captures the whole journey of in its entirety. And I think the beauty of the book is that it gives the reader a varied insight into the journey. So that's what the book is about, and that was the idea that I had pitched in to the publisher when I was thinking of writing this book.
Now, one of the things that I think makes this book particularly interesting, obviously anybody that's in the food industry or generally in supply chain is going to really take some things away from this. But maybe more personally, every single human being on Earth is part of the food supply chain in the fact that we are consumers. So are there changes or trends that are being seen at the consumption end of the food supply chain that are driving significant change back through all of the links in that chain, all the way back to the beginning where production happens?
Yes, in terms of the links, I think it's very important to understand those links from a consumer point of view, because we as consumers look at the food only from the shelves in the supermarkets or perhaps market stalls in local markets, but we do not really understand what goes behind the scenes in getting the food to those shelves or for that matter to our tables. So it is important to go back not only from the manufacturer's point of view, but also right up to the agricultural sector to see how the food is produced, the raw materials, so in terms of the vegetables, the fruits, the grains, in terms of meat, for example, how that is grown, how that is produced. And I think it is essential in today's world that the consumers do have a view of that. It has come more to light in the recent horse meat scandal in the UK, which was the mislabeling of the beef burgers, and what was found that there were traces of horse meat in it. And as a consumer, nobody knew what they were buying because the labels did not say what it was. But then they found out after testing that it contained horse meat. And then they also found out later on that the subcontracting process behind the scenes actually created this challenge where some of the even the manufacturer did not know that the consignment was contaminated with horse meat. And so I think in today's world, it's very, very essential that this channel is backtracked to understand what is going on in that food supply chain.
Now, although generally speaking, you know, we can talk about the food supply chain as one thing, you actually break it down to a more detailed level in the book, and you talk about the fact that there are actually three distinct chains, which you define as produce, grains, and then the third being meat or protein. When we look at these chains from beginning to end, what are the major differences between those three chains?
Right. So if you look at the different chains in terms of where the food that is produced in the production stage or the agricultural stage, as some may call it, that will follow different routes. So, for example, if you're looking at a protein chain, you know, looking at perhaps a meat supply chain getting to the consumer, but also the fact that that protein chain may have different levels of innovation in it in terms of, say, the dairy industry getting involved, not only meat requirement, but in terms of vegetarian people, then they need the pulses and that coming in. So you could say that protein as one part of it, but in today's world, where if you look at the consumption of meat in China and the level of protein, because protein is a difficult bit to get in the chain. Carbohydrates are the easiest things. And so, for example, in the latest trends in terms of consumption patterns, as the lifestyles and the wages have gone up in China, the consumption of protein, or in brackets, say, for example, meat, has gone up. So to actually have that inclusion of the rise in protein consumption, which means that the grain that is being produced for individual consumption, for example, human consumption, half of that may start getting into the animal feed supply chain, which is again leading to creation of more protein in the human supply chain. So, you know, there are different chains. They all intertwine at some point anyway within that journey. But it depends on the final product that's landing up on our tables. So, you know, the vegetable supply chain, the fruit supply chain has its own challenges. It's a very different domain because that does not intertwine with the direct protein chain. But the grain and the protein chains may intertwine at some point within that journey.
Now, it's interesting that you mentioned the impact that the difference between human consumption in the supply chain versus animal consumption in the supply chain. You also mention in the book that in a way there's a third, I guess you could loosely call it consumer, that's coming into play, and that's the redirection of some things that would be thought of as food as used for, say, biofuels. So corn is being pulled out of the supply chain or a derivative from the corn and is going off to a different kind of consumer. How has the expansion or the use, the purpose of the things that were originally just between human and animal consumption, how is that causing change that we've found alternate uses for these products?
Right. So I think this stems from today's challenges of food sustainability in the world. So we have a population that's been projected that by 2050 we are going to have 9 billion people in the world. And this whole issue about whether we have the appropriate levels of food available for feeding 9 billion 9 billion human beings on Earth, leave alone animals, because, you know, that's again a different challenge. And as we start growing or producing more animals in the system to feed human beings in that stage, that is going to have an impact. Now, the point that, under sustainability, we have various challenges coming in from, moving away from, oils found in the Earth's core and trying to move away to more sustainable ways of energy. And there where people have started now producing, from corn, for example, as you've said, fuel coming out of grains. Now, that has an additional impact on the availability of grains for human consumption, because we are moving away, we are kind of diverting an inventory of grains that are absolutely fit for human consumption to produce, oil, for example, for energy generation, or for example, ethanol and these kind of categories of products. Plus, it is also happening not only from the fact that we have produced this grain and we're diverting. A large part of the farmland is being utilized to grow crops for biofuels instead of for human consumption. So it has a double impact of not only utilizing what the current inventory is, but also reducing what is arable land to actually feed into the energy generation supply chain. So everything is a supply chain, technically, whether it is a food supply chain or it is energy generation supply chain. The core raw material is the same, which is a grain, but then the diversion of that will have an impact on either supply chain, unless we have a capacity to grow almost double or triple the amount of grain, and then we say that each supply chain has its own availability. But I don't think that's going to happen, because the trade-off is that one supply chain is going to miss because of the other.
And especially when you start talking about something that there's a fixed quantity of, when you talk about the arable or the farmable land, nobody's going to invent more. I mean, obviously there are alternate ways we can grow things, but we pretty much have about as much land as we're going to get. And so if demand is going to continue to not only diversify but increase, hopefully it's going to drive some kind of innovation to give us an alternate way to come up with product.
That's true. I think innovation is key, and I've got a chapter in the book which talks about the different types of innovation happening within the food sector, and I think that's also key from procurement people in procurement jobs or people who are buyers. They also have to look at the availability at the end of the day, and this trade-off between the diversion of the food produced along different supply chains will have an impact on people in those jobs. But it's also that innovation. So we can say there is a lot of innovation happening in terms of trying to increase the food produced, the quantity of food produced. There's a lot of innovation. Now, again, this is controversial, because not every country in the world will adhere to genetically modified crops. Some countries do, some countries don't. Now, that GMO scenario is, again, to try and increase the level of food produced and the type of food being produced. So innovations are happening. There is a big challenge from the other side due to climate change and weather patterns and the ability or the availability of arable land, the availability of water, the availability of other resources required in the production of food. And so, although we may have at one end say that, yes, we have the innovation happening in terms of trying to increase the food production, but we do have innovations happening in fertilizers and, chemicals being sprayed on the crops, etc. There's all sorts of things happening within the food sector, right from looking at disease-resistant seeds and stuff. So there is a level of science trying to change things. There's a level of demand patterns trying to change what happens in the food supply chain. So I think it's a very, very complex scenario right now, and it is going to increase as we see the weather patterns changing in the world. And that has happened in terms of Europe, where wheat production has had a big change in terms of availability over a couple of years, and then you suddenly find one day that the bread has the price of bread has gone up very steep. And recently, if you've seen in the UK, for example, the price of bread is almost, a loaf of bread costs 50p less than it was perhaps a year or 2 years ago. And this may, it may not happen due to perhaps the availability of wheat so much, but as the fuel price is going down. So there's a lot of changes happening. There's a lot of dynamics within the food supply chain. So nobody can put a finger and say, look, I'm going to be able to solve the problem. But it's trying to. So from a buyer's perspective also, it's trying to look at the dynamics happening there and then trying to get the right decisions in place.
Now, one of the other things that you talk about, and this was a section of the book that I particularly enjoyed, when you're looking at that complexity, and again, as I had said before, with the three different kinds of chains, we also have a tendency to think of each chain as a series of relatively equal links, but that, in fact, is not the case. And you discuss in the book that within these chains, there are pockets where the greatest amount of risk resides, and there are alternate pockets where the greatest amount of influence resides within the chain. Can you talk to me a little bit generally about where most of the risk is versus where most of the influence is within the food supply chain?
Right. Well, each kind of food product or each food supply chain will have its own risks and influences. Now, at the end of the day, brief example, the horse meat scandal. It was a very easy supply chain in the sense that somebody, the manufacturer asked for beef. The beef provider or the farmer would have provided the beef, and the patties would have been made, etc. Very, very simple. But once the order for the beef was given by the manufacturer, it went to six different subcontracts going across multiple countries within Europe. So the product was not changed. Product was not changing hands six times. The product was changing hands only once. But the subcontracting that was being done of the order happening six times led to the scenario where somebody thought actually we need to provide horse meat instead of the beef. So it's that risk in the sense that we do not have the visibility, we do not have the transparency in the supply chain. Once the order has gone out, you don't know what's happening in the first year, second year, third year, fourth year, and so on and so forth. So that network perspective to understand what's happening behind the scenes is a very key scenario for manufacturers today, or retailers for that matter, who are directly purchasing from manufacturers or even their own labels. So risks are aplenty. Risk can go from the safety of the product right to disruption, where the products are not being able to arrive on the shelves. It could be from weather patterns tackling it, or providing the challenge for, so for example, cocoa beans or coffee beans being hit by hurricanes within the regions of cultivation, to as simple as somebody putting or packaging the wrong product into the pack. So for example, I've got a case study where Cadbury's chocolate had to recall a million chocolate bars a couple of years ago because the packaging did not have the sentence saying that it can be harmful for nut allergy due to manufacturing process. So because that particular sentence was not there on the packaging, they had to recall all the Easter eggs and chocolate. So it's a very, very complex issue. So the risks will arrive at different locations in that supply chain, and the challenge for the supply chain directors, the challenge for the people in the supply chain is to understand how far and how wide their networks are, and to try and create the visibility and transparency in the system. Now, when you said influence, I think arises from where or who is the kind of driving force within the supply chain. So in terms of food retailers, some of them do have a lot more influence in the system, because they are the front-facing of the supply chain to the customers, and they're providing the shelf space, etc. But some of the influence may be at the management. So the Procter and Gamble's of this world or Nestle, and they do have a lot of influence in the system as the food manufacturers and because their supply chain networks are so complex where they're sourcing from. But at some point of time, because people don't realize this, that the seed manufacturers or the seed producers, for example, may also have a big influence in the food production scenario. And so if they play their influence, there may be no the right availability of grains flowing through the supply chain for anybody, for that matter, the manufacturer or retailer to actually utilize that inventory. So the influence can arrive at different points in the supply chain as against the risk, and it is very important to try and then trade off this risk and the influence together to find the right solution for that supply chain.
And so it actually sounds like there's a lot of cases where the risk and the influence coincide. You know, if you're talking about the horse meat scandal, for instance, on the one hand, from a retail perspective, Tesco would have an awful lot of influence because they're the face of the customer and they can make certain demands around what sort of product is made available to them, and they're going to try to drive pricing. But on the other hand, if something goes wrong, whether from a straight safety perspective or, as you wrote about in a recent article, actual food crime where things are being mislabeled, they're also going to take the greatest amount of risk because they're the brand or the corporate name that people are familiar with that ended up handing that inferior product over to them.
That's absolutely right, Kelly, because that does have a big issue, and that does have a big influence on, or I would say, consumer power, influence of consumer power on the brand. So for the retailer, although they are bearing the risk from the upstream supply chain, they're also bearing the risk from the downstream side of things, where they are the brand that is front facing. And so when the horse meat scandal happened, the kind of major retailers in the UK immediately put out a statement saying, you know, their own brand products did not have any of those issues of mislabeling or procurement issues because they were buying local, for example. And they said that the issues that cropped up or the challenges that cropped up were from other brands in the supply chain that they had perhaps not looked at intently, and they had just looked at the brand image and they had bought on the basis of that. So they immediately segregated in terms of an external product as well as against their internal label, and said that all their internal labels were okay because they had full control. And that's where I said the visibility, transparency, and the control over the supply chain is a key in terms of these influences as well as the risks encountered.
So if visibility and transparency are really the keys to improving control of what's moving through the food supply chain, what are the major things that are happening today, either in terms of companies making investments or just simply progress at doing things better? What are companies doing to improve both visibility and traceability?
Right. So in terms of, say, for example, traceability is a very important aspect of both the food supply chain and the pharmaceutical supply chain. You know, they have to have a complete traceability right up to the kind of production of the food and how that produced grain or produced meat or whatever lines up into the final product. So they are trying very hard to create that. But of course, some of the cases, recent cases, have shown that it's not always possible to do it. Now, in terms of the different challenges and the different solutions for it, a lot of new solutions are based on technology. And these may be database sharing of between different entities in the supply chain, things like control towers where the kind of most influential entity in the supply chain has full visibility of what's happening in the supply chain by utilizing this concept called control towers, which is again a software scenario using internet and GPS locations, all sorts of data that is coming in. And so this issue of big data being utilized for creating visibility and transparency. Now, there are things like looking at DNA mapping of the produce. There are things like using business models technology. So, for example, looking at models like efficient consumer response or looking at vendor management inventory or CPFR. You know, these are these new terms which the retailer and the manufacturers try and work collaboratively and create those relationships that will ease some of these risks and challenges that are faced with regards to transference and visibility. Now, it's not only always on the basis of health and safety, because some of it may be due to demand pattern changes, and that will also have an impact on the food. And one more thing that's coming up, which is rapidly increasing within the food sector, is about food waste and sustainability. And so it's no longer saying that, okay, we are happy, you know, we can't do anything about it because the demand patterns have changed and we have all this food which we are sending to the landfill because, you know, we will bear the losses, but, you know, we can't really do anything about it because that is no longer a solution because of food waste and sustainability. Now, supply chain entities have to make sure that very little of that food should go to the landfills, and they have to start looking at solutions to either optimize their inventory levels in terms of the consumer demand, or find ways to innovate so that the shelf life is increased of the product, or perhaps find out kind of business models or social models where there's a circular economy concept created where the food is coming back, if it's not utilized, is back into the system and something else can be done about it. Now, it may not be possible every time with food that is already manufactured, for example, has been value added. But even at a raw material stage, as fruits and vegetables, there are instances where fruit and vegetable which has been rejected, for example, by retailers will land up into manufacturing bases somewhere else. And that's a good thing because it's creating the relationship. And it's not always technology that helps to do it. It's the relationships created between buyers and suppliers that can go a long way. And sometimes the human relationships have a more or a better chance in terms of creating solutions for tackling those issues than technology always. So I always feel that technology is good only up to a level that the data is right and the data is analyzed correctly. Otherwise, it's just a set of data. And so it's the relationship between the human beings and the technology that drives the food supply chain forward or in the future, where the transparency visibility which shows that the food landing up at our tables is safe for us to eat, is not been tainted, is not contaminated, and that's why the UK government, you know, in the latest paper that they created after the horse meat scandal, have brought out two very big words which were not there, which were not present in the literature, as a food fraud and food crime, which we know, for example, has always happened. Opportunism has always been there in the food sector. These two things have always happened, but now it's been coined as something. There is a task force that looks at it intently and is trying to find out before the food hits the shelves, or so that whether there is a crime committed or a fraud being committed within that food sector and the food supply chain. So there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes in terms of trying to tackle these risks within that food supply chain.
And it's interesting when you talk about the impact that how waste is handled ends up having back on the chain. I mean, to some extent, there's probably a little bit of circular economy going on there, because I have to think that in some ways, the optimal waste or disposal approach that is chosen can eventually actually have an effect on production. So let's say that there's a lot of something that's being put into the waste stream, and a company figures out that there's this alternate use for it, and they can start selling the waste for that. Over time, some of that demand, like we've seen with biofuels, for example, could actually start to increase to the point where it almost eclipses the food demand for the same product. So something that started as an effective waste channel can actually become a new source of demand.
That's absolutely right, Kelly. That's very, very interesting that you've raised that, because recently some of my colleagues, we were just discussing this same issue, that what if that waste actually is creating a bigger demand and you start producing food for the waste supply chain and not for the actual consumption supply chain. And you're right. You're right, absolutely right. And that has to be looked at in a very delicately, because I think our biggest challenge is feeding the world and this challenge of 2050, where everybody's setting their sights for 2050 with the 9 billion population. And so what you're saying is absolutely right, because business supersedes the main objective or the main goal in this scenario. And you're absolutely right. We have to look at that circular economy in a more positive sense, in terms of reduce or utilizing the waste that's been created in the consumption supply chain to be going back and not creating a new supply chain entity itself that feeds directly into the waste supply chain. Yes, you're right.
Now, a moment ago, one of the other things you were talking about is the importance of human-to-human relationships above and beyond what technology allows us to do. And one of the relationships that it sounds like is particularly key for the effectiveness of the food supply chain is the relationship between the public sector and the private sector in allowing the food to, in fact, go from farm to fork. Could you talk a little bit about how critical the public-private partnership is in the food supply chain?
Right. So I think from a public-private sector perspective, I'm looking at public sector as not as a food producer directly, because we have these challenges where a state or a country might start looking at food production as their entity and then start having control over it. So there are certain countries that will not allow an export of some of the food products that they produce, whereas some will not allow the import of certain things. So there will always be a kind of public sector, a state influence on what comes in and what goes out of the country in terms of the production of food. Now, from a public-private sector partnership, I think when we start talking of individual farmers or small farmholder entities, I think it's the public sector or the governments or the policymakers that are going to provide the necessary resources, the capacities, the technologies that will aid food producers to try and create more value in the system. So from a public sector, there's a case study in my book about the food parks being created in India, and then the new government investing a lot into creating these state-of-the-art food parks, which allow, but this is more from a manufacturing perspective, where they're allowing the food producers to come and directly integrate with the food manufacturers, or even go up the value chain, where the food producer, now the farmer says, look, I've got all this, for example, tomato that I am growing. Now I can go up the value chain, and I can now, with the aid of the public sector or with the aid of the government, I can now start my own ketchup plant, or I can start my own bottling plant, or canning plant, something like which we are saying that the food that's going up the value chain and it's benefiting the farmer, it's giving them more returns. It's also, I think, a bigger issue within developing countries is the wastage of food in terms of once it's harvested, so post-harvest food loss, as it's called. Once it's harvested, from that point in the system to it reaching either the consumer or it reaching the manufacturer, 40% of that produce is lost. And this is diabolical, because when you're saying you're losing 40% of your produce and you're trying to feed a growing population, then it's a no-brainer to say, why can't we start reducing that wastage right there after it is produced? And so the public sector, private sector partnership is a key or an essential ingredient in optimizing and creating solutions for that food supply chain. I don't think it's so much of a competition between the public sector and private sector in terms of the production or the manufacturing of food, because more and more public sector organizations have privatized in the last 20, 30 years now in most countries. Very, very few countries will start controlling the food supply chain cycle. But there is a big influence. So a couple of chapters in my book talk about this influence that governments have in terms of the food supply chain and internally within their own domains, as well as the influence they will try and create externally for their own political gain. So it's a very fascinating scenario that if left alone, the supply chain can just go on, but actually it is used as a kind of political tool in a lot of places when embargoes are put in and negotiations are done for certain things. So it is very key. So there's a case study again in the book which talks about the cucumber fallout in Europe in the last couple of years, and it talks about the mango ban in the UK last year, and how the public sector, private sector came together to try and find a very amenable solution to that, because it was international supply chains and the aspect of regulation when the food moves between international boundaries and the impact different regulations have on that system. And so it's a key. You know, understanding regulation is also a big key within this public sector, private sector partnerships. Creating smarter regulation, creating regulation that promotes safety of food, brings the right food to our tables, but also which does not impede international trade is again a key part of that relationship. So I think it's a very, very important part where the country, the state has to play and create the right incentives for private producers, manufacturers, retailers in the supply chain to try and get, you know, the food to the consumer, because at the end of that, that's the objective. If the food is not reaching the consumer, there's no point in the whole supply chain. And so, as you rightly said, yes, we need to have that relationship and a very strong relationship at that, actually.
So most of what we've talked about is, in fact, about the supply chain. But you also take a very specific look at logistics within the book. And if we focus on that for a minute, what are some of the unique logistics challenges that exist, whether it comes to actually fleet moving the food, or from a warehouse and inventory management perspective, storing the food safely and with minimal waste, as you mentioned, for instance, the 40% loss, as it goes on its journey?
Yes, I think the movement of food is crucial anyway, because we are looking at international supply chains, and we are looking at a scenario where, so for example, in the UK, a lot of our food that's available in the retail spaces is imported. It comes from overseas, and it's not only because it's not available yet. It's also because the consumer demand for it and the differing diaspora who would like to try out food from different parts of the globe. And then the aspect of optimization, where the retailers would like a certain, so perennial supply of bananas or perennial supply of apples or so, which means that if it is not available in the UK or it's not available in one part of the world, then you have to try and source it from the other. So logistics is key. And logistics is key from not only from the aspect, as you said, of storing the food, but moving the food. It's key from keeping the food in the right consistency. So the aspects of storage may be because, you know, it has to stay at a certain location before it's sent off on its journey further, or the type of travel that it encounters. So whether it is by trucks or whether it is by plane or whether it is by sea or whatever it is. So, you know, you have to deal with different foodstuffs in a different way, and the kind of easiest approach is to try and use containers, is to use sea, you know, for the logistics. But of course, it depends. It depends. You know, sometimes it may be easier to, you know, it may take more time by sea. It may have, but it may have the advantage of being in a refrigerated container. Whereas if it's flown by air, it may have the advantage that it reaches you faster. But actually, by the time it's being loaded or unloaded, that product may not be in a refrigerated scenario, which means that the food still can be degraded, although it has reached the warehouse or the country faster than by sea. So a lot of stuff has to be taken into consideration. And then there is this whole issue nowadays of having the same truck delivering different types of food, because the type of retail deliveries that are being done from, say, warehouse to individual retail stores, or, you know, between retail stores and smaller shops and stuff. So So the lorries itself have different refrigerated parts of it, and you cannot mix different types of foods with each other because they may have an impact on the consistency of the other. And so bananas cannot be kept with other fruit together because of the gases that come out are emitted out of bananas as they're ripening and stuff. So there is a lot to be learned in terms of how the foods are kept within the system, within the travel journey, as well as stored at the warehouse. But it is the ultimate challenge to make sure that the food is in the right consistency, the food is safe, it's not got contaminated. And so logistics plays a very, very important part. There is a lot of innovation in terms of the containers. When I say container, not the containers on the ships, but small boxes or whatever which hold the food, so that container. For example, there is a case study of cut pineapple coming in from North Africa into the supermarkets in the UK, and that pineapple is not cut in the UK, but the pineapple is cut and packaged in Ghana, for example. But the packaging solution to that, which makes it easier for it to be traveling all the way from, say, Ghana to the supermarket shelves in the UK, does not degrade the product. Anyway, obviously, it will degrade over a period of time, but the kind of shelf life that has provided for that pineapple means that it is coming in the right consistency and right quality. So, yes, so as I said, there are a couple of chapters which talks about the logistics methods, which talks about the challenges faced there. It talks about international challenges again, moving between boundaries and the logistics requirements. So sometimes you may have to use multimodal logistics where a certain country allows only a certain kind of mode of transport up to the borders, and you have to kind of change that and take a different mode of transport further on. And so, for example, some things are very bizarre, which I found out when I was researching for the book. So the fish caught in the North Sea is frozen, is sent to China, filleted, packaged, and then sent back. Again, it's frozen and then sent back to the supermarket shelves in the UK and the US, which means that it's traveling to and fro, so many thousands and thousands of miles before it reaches the supermarket shelf, which is bizarre because it can be done at local point of catching that fish. But because of business norms and because of bottom lines and because of all sorts of profitability issues, for example, there's a bizarre logistics network created for the fish. And it's not only one such such product. There are loads of products that are going crisscrossing across the globe, just because at some place they may be cheaper to pack, or some place may be cheaper to cheaper modes of transport or whatever it is. And I think in the future the industry is going to start looking at it more intently. They are going to think about these modes of transport. They're going to, because at the end of the day, these challenges are going to abound. They're not going to be reducing. Climate change itself has created more challenges right now, right from logistics, transportation, to just storing goods and the amount of time it can be stored and so on and so forth. So what you rightly said, yes, logistics has a big impact to play, or a big influence to play within that food supply chain.
So the book came out over the summer, and you've written a couple of additional posts that are on the Kogan Page site. And in fact, I will share links to those on today's episode page for anyone that's interested in reading them. It feels natural as we wrap one year and look to begin another to ask about what's next. So is there anything you can share with us, either about what you see as an up-and-coming topic within the area of food supply chain and logistics, or with regard to your own work and research in the area?
Right. So, as I said, food waste, food sustainability, food fraud, food crime are currently big things that are happening. One of the biggest things that is going to hit the food supply chain, it is actually already there, and the governments are looking at it, is the reduction of sugar. And that's going to impact on a lot of the drinks market, the drinks manufacturers. It's going to hit the food supply chain in terms of even if you go upstream into the production of sugar and the different substitutes for sugar and all sorts of things. So sugar is a key thing. So a few years ago, fat within the food was a big thing. Now it's going to be sugar. There's a very good thing within the UK that the food industry, on the BS of the government, created something called the traffic light system, where the labeling of the food and the labeling of the requirement for human consumption is there. So if it's a red, so fat is shown as red or amber, then you know that, you know, this food may be harmful for you and so forth. So the traffic light labeling system for a consumer is useful because they can see the product and then decide for themselves whether they should be consuming it or not. So there are subtle changes happening within the food industry that's going to affect in the next year, for example. Innovation is key. A lot of things are going on within the sector for innovation of food to create perhaps, you know, different types of food products for different consumer groups. So, for example, the health conscious may want food products with, say, vitamins added to it and so on and so forth. So, you know, there are a lot of these new types of food products. So if you look at smoothies market, there's a big market that has been created within that drink sector with healthy smoothies and additional elements to the smoothie. So there's a lot of innovation being tried with different ingredients there. And so on and so forth. So there's a lot of stuff happening in even this 1 year or 2 years. The logistics part of it will prevail. You know, that will happen as a part of operational issues. So that's why the book tackles the supply chain into a number of issues. So the operational part of it is the optimization of current solutions for the challenges they're facing on a day-to-day level. But the policy issues, the international issues, the issues about risk management, food fraud, food crime, waste, sustainability, availability of land, availability of water, availability of energy, for example, within developing countries, the aspect that value creation or co-creation within developing countries is going to be key. You can see Coca-Cola working to create water sustainability in major parts of the world because, of course, water is their main ingredient. And if they don't work on sustaining water supply, they are going to lose out on their upstream supply of water. Brands like Nestle and Cadbury's or for the matter, chocolate producers are working with cocoa bean producers and coffee bean producers and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of stuff happening. For a consumer, I think from a consumer's perspective, the food supply chain is about the availability of food that they need and the safety of the food that they need. I think the consumers don't go as far to understand or think about where the food coming in. But I think another challenge in the sector, which we haven't discussed as yet, but it's about online shopping. It's about the aspect of, I don't know how much it is in the US, but in the UK, the aspect of discounters these shops which are selling food products so cheaply that the supermarkets have not been able to rival them. The discounters have actually grown in size over the past 1 or 2 years, and actually they've eaten away a big market share of these supermarkets. And it has changed the dynamics of availability of food. And this is not fresh food, but this is more of long shelf life food and confectionery items and snacking items. So this has had a big impact on it. So I would say that there are a lot of things happening. It's a very dynamic world. It's a very dynamic system. Small things can create a problem. So at the moment, the milk supply chain has a big challenge within the UK retail environment because, you know, you get 4 pints of milk for a pound. From a consumer's perspective, that's great. But from the dairy farmer's perspective, it's an absolute no-no because they are facing a big problem. A lot of dairy farmers are going out of business because they can't sustain the price because their costs are very high and they have to bear the brunt of cheap milk prices. So there is a lot of challenge. And I think somewhere down the line, it's not only a year, but as you ask me what's happening in the next year, in the year there are short-term changes going to happen. But I think we all have to think about food production and the food supply chain from a more longer-term perspective. Of what's going to happen. As consumers also, we need to think about where our food comes in, what we are consuming, and are we ready to pay a little bit more so that the food is sustainable and our sources are more sustainable from a longer-term perspective.
So that's certainly a level of complexity, both from a professional as well as a personal standpoint, that most of us probably take for granted, don't give quite enough thought to as we sit down to each meal. So, Professor Donny, as we wrap up our time here, I would like to repeat for anyone that missed it in my introduction, the book is Food Supply Chain Management and Logistics from Farm to Fork. It is available for sale on Amazon as well as from the Kogan Page website. As I mentioned, you recently received an award for your work, which is most deserved, so congratulations on that. Professor Donny, thank you so much for your time today, as well as for sharing your knowledge and experiences through this book and your other writing.
Thank you very much. It was very pleasurable for me. Thank you.
Thank you.